Oh, my goodness.
Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Sangster. I am an alcoholic. It's great to be here. No pressure.
She's going to bring it.
I'm going to bring you something. I'm not sure what. Bad case of alcoholism that I've been able to recover thanks to God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right. And you can even move that over if you want.
Oh, okay. I can move things around. Anyway, I'm very delighted to be here. I'm very honored. I'm really just very excited. Got a call sometime this summer, and somebody wanted me to come to Atlanta to speak. I'm like, I'm in Richmond, and I have to tell you, this is very exciting for me. It's the first time I've actually been flown somewhere to speak, so I'm a little anxious, but that's all right. I'm here, and I'm grateful. So thank you to Kathy. Thank you to the committee. Thanks to Katie and Trey for the road trip. I don't think we shut up the whole time. We're like the whole time, and ate, and John, Kathy's husband, who picked us up and entertained us at the airport. And I'd like to say my husband Bob is with me, and he's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of the steps and the power of God and people like you, we'll be celebrating 26 years on Sunday of marriage. And and so, you know, when she asked us, like, oh, that's our anniversary weekend, and I'm like, perfect. What a way to give back to this fellowship that has given me my life, my husband's life, saved our marriage, and the most important thing, my son. I am very selfish. Our son, who's 24 and our only child and the thing I love the most in the world, caught this disease and ended up hitting the bottom, thank God, at 18. He's been sober 6.5 years, and he's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm a big fan of AA, even though I resisted it for 10 years. My sobriety date, I don't even know if I said that yet. Okay, I am an alcoholic. May 30th, 2006 is my sobriety date. And every time I say that, I really am so grateful, and I almost want to cry because I should be dead. I came in here in 96 and in and out for 10 years and was always given a strong... Are you pointing to me to do something? Oh. I saw somebody point. Anyway, where was I?
10 years in and out.
10 years in and out. Yeah. And I was always given... I've been very, very fortunate. I've never had sponsors when I first came in 96 and through, you know, the 10 years in and out. I think I had 3 sponsors. And they were never, just don't drink, go to meetings, Debbie. They were like, you have a serious case of alcoholism that is fatal, and you're going to die if you don't work these steps and get in the middle of AA. You know, I was like, oh, my gosh. But the message was carried to me, but I like to lead a double life in my mind. I'm going to agree with you, but I think that I'm too smart. Some of these things don't apply to me. And I need to get some balance in my life. And I need to start being a good mother and work harder and all that. And that always ended up being a disaster for me. And you'll hear my story. I'm very grateful that I hit the type of bottom that it got my attention. And what I realized is I really overestimated my mind and my thinking and my will and underestimated the disease and spiritual malady of alcoholism that uses all the good things in my life and my mind against me and will get me over here and away from you all. But anyway, so May 30th, 2006, grateful for that. I do have a home group. It meets on Wednesdays and Sundays. It's Speaking of Steps, and it's a 3 legacy group. We're very solid group. I need a solid solution for the type of alcoholism I have. I have a sponsor. Spoke to her earlier. She's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I have the honor and privilege of walking with folks on this path. And so I am sponsored by a woman that's sponsored in the middle of the circle, the triangle, and she insists that I'm in all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous and being honest, and she needs to know that she's my sponsor. And I've been willing to do all of those things the past 12 and a half years. And my life has changed beyond, and not so much on the outside, well, a lot on the outside too, but the ability to live despite what I think, feel, or believe, and to continue to show up and not have to live on about 50 different psychotropics to be able to function in this world or in and out of psych wards constantly. And the only psych wards I go in the past 12 and a half years is to take a meeting because I love psych wards. One of my sponsors said, are you going to make Tucker's, which was our psychiatric detox, which I was in there many times. So is that becoming your home group? Or yeah, but anyway, so I've got a little twang. This isn't a Richmond accent. I grew up in Owensboro, Kentucky. And the youngest of three gals. Somebody know Owensboro, Kentucky here? You do? Oh,
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a small town. It's like, yeah, a small town in Kentucky. So lived there the first 20 years of my life. I'm the youngest of three gals. My dad was a boilermaker. My mom was a homemaker. And boilermaker is a blue-collar guy that welds and does all that. And anyway, they did the best they could, but I grew up in a crazy alcoholic home. My dad was a blackout vodka drinker. You know, he would work during the week and come home for dinner and all that. And then on the weekends, all hell, you know, he'd get the paycheck on Friday and, you know, he wouldn't come home. And then we either go out looking for him or he'd, you know, come home. And then he and my mom would fight. And there was a lot of violence. Shotguns, police, broken windows, telephones pulled out of the wall. You know, they party and leave for 3 or 4 days. So anyway, you know, they were doing the best they could. And but as a result, the only reason I'm telling you that, I don't know if that makes me alcoholic, but it certainly made me neurotic. I developed panic anxiety at a very early age. And that played a big part into me almost my alcoholism hiding behind a lot of stuff that I thought was a mental illness that almost killed me. So anyway, I had my first drink when I was 13. It was just a fit, and I was going to a party or something. And the very first time I drank, oh, and by the way I got the alcohol, when you're 13, it's hard to get alcohol. My dad, I asked him to buy it for me, and he did. And that didn't even sound unusual to me until I got sober. And then I had a child. I'm like, oh, my God, my dad bought me alcohol when I was 13. But, you know, as in our big book, it says the alcoholic life becomes normal. You know, everybody drank. My dad was a black. Hell, he probably was in a blackout when he bought it for me. But I drank that stuff and blacked out the very first time I drank. And after that, I didn't like, oh, my God, I've, you know, found the magic elixir. I didn't. You know, I think at that point I was doing it to fit in and got sick. And, you know, so I went on with life and through high school. And I was very, I think what I saw that alcohol did, you know, to my family, because my dad beat the hell out of my mom. And, you know, he would embarrass me. My friends would come over and he was very inappropriate. And so I kind of, you know, became a goody two-shoes, and I was always looking for some. I didn't know this till I got sober, but I had this God-shaped hole in me, and I never felt okay. But, of course, growing up in a family like that, I guess you wouldn't feel okay because there's a lot of secrets, you know. And but I remember when I got to high school, you know, I'm about 5'10". I was about 5'10", about 100 pounds, and my nose and my feet grew first. There was nothing else going on. I mean, it was like the carpenter's dream and, you know, all that. And so, you know, a lot of people say I felt different. I was. I mean, all the boys are this tall, and I'm this tall and skinny and, you know. So anyway, I wanted to do anything to fit in. I was like a pretzel. I would just bend myself into anything. And, you know, it was like I would look at things like what can make me feel good. And it's like those type of people. I want to be like them or this or that or a cheerleader. And somehow I ended up becoming a cheerleader, and I was a swimmer, and I was involved in things. And I think that kept me from drinking, you know, because a lot of those things meant something to me. I was an athlete, and that prevented me from getting, you know, starting the partying in high school. I mean, my son, he hit his first bottom at 15. I'm like, thank God I got to drink till I was 36, man. I needed to. Lord. I mean, seriously, he got sober at 18. He's 6.5 years sober. Lord. So, anyway, So I stayed out of trouble, and that stuff was all good on the surface, you know. It you know, was good for me. So I went on and, you know, really started partying when I was about 17 or 18. And had, you know, friends. We'd party and drink, stay out all night, go to work the next day with the same clothes I had on before. But I didn't have a lot of consequences. And I had a lot of fun with drinking. And that's why I look at my son. He's sober at 18. I was just getting started, you know. So I moved out of that small town. My dad finally, I think, after his third or fourth rehab, got sober, but he didn't, he hated AA. But anyway, he stayed dry for like 20 years. He was a very angry man. But about then I was like, I'm getting the hell out of this town. And I moved to Lexington, Kentucky. I had a bunch of girlfriends that were going to University of Kentucky, and, you know, I wanted to get out of town. And so up there we just partied and had a lot of fun with some girlfriends, and, you know, not a lot of consequences other than like being late for work or, you know, being fired or things like that, you know, from being so hungover. But I'm really good at talking. One time I got fired from this story's just showing up for some reason. I worked at a bank, and they called me in because I was, you know, hungover every day because I was out partying every night. And somehow I convinced them to rehire me, and I got to stay there. I mean, I am so, like, I don't know what I'm going to do, and very manipulative. But anyway, So anyway, I met a guy there in Lexington, and he ended up being my first husband. So that's how I ended up in Richmond, Virginia. And so I was about 21 when I got to Richmond, and just started partying. He and I lived together. We had a group of people, all baby boomers. It was like happy hours, and, you know, we lived in this complex where there were just a keg party every day, partying all the time. It was like a big fraternity or college, you know, is an apartment complex where I just partied all the time. That's normal to me. Didn't think anything about it. And, you know, had a lot of good times. But in the background, what's starting to go on, I start having these horrible panic attacks to where I have to go to the emergency room. I think I'm dying. And, you know, I feel like I'm having a heart attack and a brain tumor and aneurysm. I mean, you just literally feel like you're dying. And so I'd be rushed to the emergency room, and they're like, you know, I don't think I smoked or anything at that point. They're like, you're healthy. There's nothing wrong with you. So what I found is just, I really like drinking. It makes me feel good. But I found with this high level of anxiety that I started having and panic attacks, I really like to drink every opportunity, because that was the only thing that would kind of, you know, let me breathe and feel like I was okay. So that's why I became a daily drinker right away and continued on. And then, you know, I can deal with consequences. For what alcohol does for me, I'm willing to put up with some stuff. But the first legal consequence I got was when I was, it was in 1986. And I was leaving a party, and that's also the same year I got married to the first husband. And I got pulled over and got a DUI, and it really, you know, sucked. There's a lot of stuff you have to go through, and the SR-22, and they have this ASAP thing you go to. And, you know, I was like, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, because they start talking like, are you an alcoholic? I'm like, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I just was the wrong, you know, like anybody from that party could have gotten pulled over, but it was just me. And so they, you had to go through this alcohol program, the ASAP thing. They didn't make you go to AA then, but they did say that you can't drink while you're in this program. I think it was like 6 weeks. I'm like, no problem. And that's the first time I realized it was a problem. I had to drink. And I was like, this is weird. I'm not supposed to be drinking, but I really need a drink. And so I just made sure I didn't drink the days I went to the class. So I made it through that. And it's so weird because that was in 86. 1996 is when I first ended my first psych ward. And then I get sober in 2006. I was just thinking about that today. Like, six is my lucky number, evidently. But, Anyway, so made it through that, and you know, I was married to this guy, and he would drink on the weekends and party real hard, but I started drinking all the time during the day, you know, or you know, every day. And then I was in marketing and sales, so the company I worked for, it was okay to drink at lunch. So I stopped waiting for happy hour. I had a girlfriend, I think she's sober now too, somewhere up in New York. We'd start drinking at lunchtime, and sometimes we wouldn't even go back to the office, so it was great. And so, you know, drinking's taking an exhilarating part, you know, place in my life. I mean, I love happy hour. I love drinking at lunch. I love drinking Bloody Marys on the weekends, and, you know, and I'm still hold a job, and everything's okay. And again, but what's going on in the background is I always have this feeling that something's not right. Like, I get exactly what I think I want, then I'm like, yeah. Well, I need this, or I need that, or I need to make more money, or I need a better car, or I need a better outfit, or I need a I need another husband. So, first husband wasn't working out. I think I turned 30 at the time, and he was still going out. He kept forgetting he was married. We had just built this beautiful home, and I'm like, you know what? I ain't doing this no more. So, I left, but I remember before I left, I think Bob and I, my husband, we both worked for the same company, and there was this place called Penny Lane Pub, and it was a little pub, and a bunch of us go after work and have our, you know, pints of brew and you know, hang out. And I remember me and my husband were having problems and all that, and I'm there at happy hour, and I see him coming down the aisle walking. I'm like, now, if I had that, I would be okay. Everything would be good. I did. I thought he's the best-looking man I've ever seen in my life, and he still is. Today, I'll be bitchy again tomorrow, honey. But anyway, I don't know how he puts up with me. I swear to God, he's such a good man. Anyway, So I saw him, and he saw me. And anyway, we ended up together. There were a few details to work out. I won't go into that. But anyway, but we both got divorced. And I was already in process. He was kind of in process. But anyway, yeah, that was a fun amends. But anyway, so we ended up together, and we were drinking buddies, and we were having a good time, and he liked to drink, and I liked to drink, and we liked to drink together, and you know, it was good for a while. And then let's see, we got married in 93, so 93, what is it, 26 years ago right now. I was over Maui getting ready to get probably drunk and get ready to go get married on a beach cove at sunset in a couple of days. So anyway, it you know, you think about your life, but here I am 26 years later, and I'm in Atlanta speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That's wonderful. I mean, really, but if you told me then, I'm like, you're crazy, and that's ridiculous. But So we got married, and things were good, and again, because, let me try to articulate this. I've got this thing that I have a vision of what I need in my life for me to be okay. And it's kind of this, like, okay, if it looks like this, if I have him, if I have this much money, if I have this, and I have that, and I have this, then I'm going to be okay, because I'm always not feeling okay inside, you know, but I can't quite get it because I'm looking like I should be grateful for what I have, but no, this isn't it either. And it's part of that restless, irritable, discontented, you know, that it talks about in the doctor's opinion. So I am good at getting things to feel that good God-shaped hole, and it's like putting a Band-Aid on something. You know, it's still oozing underneath the Band-Aid, and there it is again, you know. So that's kind of how it was. So I saw him, and I'm glad I got him. But, you know, and he did fill me up for a while, you know, but all then it's like, I need something else. Oh, my biological clock is ticking. I know what's wrong with me. I need a baby. So then we got pregnant, and then I needed my dream home, and we built my dream home. So finally I get everything in 1994. May 15th, 1994, our beautiful son was born. It was the happiest day of my life. And I had arrived. I had that beautiful baby. I had this beautiful home that we built. I have the husband. I have everything. And that's when I had to start drinking the morning. My drinking really changed from after having my son. I don't know. I think it's just, you know, there's at some point you cross that line, man. And I did. And that's when the drinking got unpredictable. I would take two drinks and I would be, I gotta watch my mouth. I would be faced, and then sometimes I could drink 8 or 10 glasses of wine, and I couldn't get a buzz, man. And so anyway, by then our company had us working. It's called virtual office. They rather than having to go into an office, they set you up an office at your home. So I started working from home, and that's when I really got to start drinking in the morning, Monday through Friday. Didn't have to wait till the weekend. And what happened, it's all just so kind of blurry, but, you know, I started getting very, very depressed. And there's nobody you can really talk to about that stuff when you're a poser and trying to present to the world that you've got your act together. And I got the house, got the car, got the man, and I'm trying to present, and I'm falling apart inside. And, you know, I wake up in the morning because I'm such a heavy drinker. I just am shaking. You know, I don't know whether the inside of my mind and my soul of the terror and impending sense of doom was worse than the shakes, but they were both bad. And I couldn't think my way out of it. And I was like, what is wrong with me? I have this husband. I have this beautiful child. I have this home. I have a job. I have the car. And I feel like I'm so depressed. It's so anxious. I feel like I want to off myself. Like, what is this? And so at that point, I start calling doctors and going to see psychiatrists. And they ask me about my drinking. And I'm like, no, I'm a social drinker. What society are you in? But anyway, I lied to them. But I think it started with my OB. He said, I think maybe you have some delayed postpartum depression. Maybe that's why you're so depressed. And so he started throwing some pills at me. Then I was getting worse, not better, because I'm drinking around the clock. But to me, I felt like the depression was a result of my dad had cancer at the time. Now Bob and I weren't getting along so well. I'm depressed. There's mental illness that runs in my family. My mother said I'm having a nervous breakdown. Maybe it's early menopause. You know, there's something. And I thought that if we could get this problem straightened out with these doctors, the talk therapy and the right combination of pills, that will fix and lift the depression and the anxiety. Then I can go back to normal drinking, which is, for God's sakes, at lunchtime. You know, I mean, that's my thinking. So, you know, I mean, it just never occurred, you know, like, no, drinking's not the problem. And it wasn't, because I'm telling you, I have alcoholism. It demands treatment. And alcohol, I think, saved my life until I could come to you all, until I hit bottom and got in the psych ward. Because I cannot deal with sober reality. On my own, I just can't. So I'm glad I had every drink I had, because I needed it, man. And I just, you know, keep going to these doctors and lying to them, and then they get me to talk, well, you know, God, it sounds like you had some trauma as a child. Let's talk about, you know, this and that. And, I mean, I'm seeing, like, three different doctors, and they send me to them specialists for panic and anxiety, which I do. I had terrible panic attacks and was hospitalized for them. So I'm just so loaded up on pills. I don't even know what's going on. And one day, I need to hurry this up. I haven't gotten to the first psych ward yet. Okay, so so what happened is I'm seeing these doctors, and what I am telling you, if people, their mental illness, I'm not saying people shouldn't, everybody should take their pills. I'm not telling anybody. I'm just telling you in regards to alcoholism. I'm lying about my drinking. I have alcoholism, and I didn't know it, so this, all these different things they were putting me on didn't work. I got worse, not better, because it doesn't work for alcoholism. So what ended up happening is one day I decided that I was going to get my act together. I was going to get, you know, out of my home. I was going to go over to the office. They did have a drop-in office for us to come to with secretarial support. I'm going to go hang out there, and I'm just not going to drink. And I got up, and I was like a dog chasing my tail. I couldn't even think straight. I needed a drink, but I was trying not to have a drink, and I wasn't going to drink. And I look in the mirror, and I'm just like saw myself the first time. I'm bloated. I can't even get my clothes on. I can't even think straight. And I just fell apart. I said, you know what? And this is how it became for me, like Groundhog's Day. I think I got a drinking problem, but I need a drink to think about my drinking problem, smoke a few cigarettes, and figure out how I'm going to do about my drinking problem, and we'll deal with it tomorrow and day in and day out. But that day, I couldn't get a buzz. I ended up calling my husband's mother, who's a teetotaler, and this nice Christian lady, and she didn't know what in the hell. I'm like, crazy and thrashing about in a fetal position and screaming and crying and cussing her out. And I was supposed to be watching our two-year-old son and my stepson, and he's off doing something with a work function. So anyway, I'm carted off to the psych ward, and I thought I was having a nervous breakdown, and that's where they told me, and I was highly offended. I said, what's wrong with me? Because I'm like, what new pill are they going to give me now? And they said, you're an alcoholic. And I was offended. I said, no, I'm not. I'm an account executive for AT&T. And they're like, okay, let's put her in that other room, you know. So, I mean, I was just clueless. But anyway, you know, that was my first time being, you know, put away somewhere. And so they kept me for 10 days because on top of drinking around the clock and how I drink, let me just tell you real quick, is I wake up and I get a big tall coffee cup and I put a bunch of vodka and then a little, you know, bit of orange juice because it's, and I would tell myself it's orange juice. I'd have two or three vodka drinks and two or three rum drinks with juice, with the baby's juice or apple juice or whatever I could get because, you know, I didn't want him to see how much I was drinking because he was still drinking at the time before he got sober. And then I would drink anywhere from a 6-pack to a 12-pack. And then when he got home from work, I would have his big martini, which is a stadium cup full of vodka with one olive in it. And so he's, you know, drinking. And then I start on my Marcus James Chardonnay, a big bottle of it. Then I start on red wine. Then I would drink about a pint of apricot brandy on top of taking 2 milligrams of Klonopin 3 times a day, 80 milligrams of Paxil, Seroquel, Respiril, Gabitril, and Effexor. I mean, I am not, there's other stuff too. I mean, I was gone. So anyway, they said, you should be dead. It is very dangerous. So they kept me for 10 days because I didn't know that detoxing off benzos and booze can kill you. You die. And now, since I've been around for a while, I know people that have died. And they were just like, oh, my God. So that's where I first heard the language of the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm up there in the psych ward. I'm like, alcoholic, I'm highly offended. And they want me to come to the AA meeting here. It's going to be a bunch of old damn men, I bet. And I thought, well, I could probably do them a favor. I could probably help them. I'm so smart, you know. I mean, I'm just crazy. So I wasn't going to go to the meeting, but I did. And they started putting labels to my crazy. Because remember, I told you, you know, like I had all these things. And I wanted nothing more than a baby. And I'd look at my baby in the crib and just, I loved that child more than life itself. And then half time, I don't know how that baby got in bed. I would drive drunk all the time. I mean, you know, all I wanted was that baby. And I couldn't even be a good mom. And that just puzzled me. But they started telling me why. Because I have alcoholism and I'm powerless over it. And it has nothing to do with love. That it owns me. If you're an alcoholic, you can't make up your mind to stop drinking. And they started, you know, making me feel a little better about myself because I felt awful, the shame and guilt of, you know, jeopardizing a baby's life, you know, and all the other things I did that was embarrassing. And so I got out there and I was excited. I liked the people from AA and I started going to the meetings and people were so accepting because most of the time people were like, you know, like they're kind of like, you need to do something about your drinking. You know, like people like, I hung around a lot of alcoholics. So if you have other alcoholics talking to you about your drinking, you might be an alcoholic. And so anyway, it was, you know, I really enjoyed the fellowship and I like to go and yak. You know, I'd go to meetings where, you know, people like to throw the problem du jour. And, of course, I have lots of problems, so I love to take over the meeting. Everybody would swirl around me and try to fix me. I don't go to meetings like that today. And then I started going, Kathy, you'll like this. So then I'm so smart. I read the same thing every time. Now that I'm busy and sober now, you know, my sponsor may be there 15 minutes early or half an hour early, but I get there 15 minutes late because they read the same thing every time. And finally she said, why don't you come early? And I said, or 15 minutes early. I said, you're lucky I'm here. I'm busy. I'm trying to be a mom. I'm trying to do this, trying to do that. And, I mean, I was highly offended, so I was just full of crap is what I was. And the minute they really started wanting to hold my feet to the fire, and because I'm a steamroller, I'll steamroll, and I want to complain about him and whine about things and talk about lofty ideas and talk about religion, and they're trying to keep me focused on Alcoholics Anonymous and what's in the big book, and I just didn't want to do it. And finally, I think after about, I relapsed somewhere in there at 8 months, and about a year and a half, I was like, you know what, screw these people. I'm doing good now. I learned my lesson. I almost caught that thing. I don't have that alcoholism like they do. I'm not as bad as them. And I tried for 11 months. Rational Recovery, A Course in Miracles. I mean, I did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want people telling me what to do. I don't want to commit to anything. I want to come and go as I please. And I just thought it was a little overkill. And I ended up back in the same place. I was miserable. I was drinking myself to death. And I wanted to die every day. And that was November the 13th of 1998. That was one of my sobriety dates. And that's when I knew that morning I woke up. And Val, who's our mutual friend, she was my sponsor. I think she's a long-term member of AA. And she had kept in touch with me. And I called her that morning and I said, I need help. And she said, I'll be right there. And she came and 12-stepped me. And she asked me a question. She said, do you want to live or do you want to die? Because she knew I was dying. And again, I told you how I drink, and that's how I always drink. First thing in the morning, all day long, all night long. Even, I cannot go a minute without alcohol. I can't go from one room to the next. I got to have a drink in my hand. I cannot function without alcohol. So, you know, I knew I couldn't stay sober, but she came to my house, 12-stepped me, and took me to lunch and then told me to come to her group that night and pick up a white chip, and I did. And I launched out on a vigorous program of action with Val. If any of you know her, she's about 6 foot tall, blonde, strong woman, strong member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't going to say no to her, I'm telling you. So I was scared, and I wanted to recover. And she was the perfect person for me because she didn't put up with any of my stuff, man. She cared more about my life than my feelings. And when I wanted to start complaining about Bob and how bad he was and da-da-da, she said, you know what, you don't need to be worrying about him. You got a bad case of alcoholism. You're going to die. You need to focus on going to the meetings. What are you doing? Praying, you know. Maybe he might be an alcoholic. What a great example you're setting. But anyway, she proceeded to put me in the middle of the circle and triangle of alcohol. Anonymous, in the unity, in the service, in working through the steps and taking the steps and starting to apply the principles in my life. And my life got great. And you know, I mean, it's great. But I was sober and I wasn't living on all that stuff. Then Bob got sober in 2000. And so we're all sober. And life's getting good. But not for me. Because I still like to lead a double life. And in my head, I had a lot of magical thinking. And I want to be happy. I want those promises and the happy, joyous, and free. And I want to put in little effort and get maximum benefit and just be happy and floaty and, you know, have no problems. And that's what I thought they said they were offering here, because I think that's what I wanted to believe. Or, you know, I just wouldn't really tell my sponsor what I was really thinking, what I'm really feeling, what I'm really believing, what I'm really doing. I just want to look good on the outside because I'm a poser. I present to the world what I want you to see. So I have this whole internal dialogue going on. So about 2.5, 3.5 years, I'm hating. People are like, how you doing? I'm doing great. And I'm sponsoring people, and I'm speaking at places, and I'm bringing turkeys to the damn alcathons. I mean, I'm doing it all. And I'm just like, you know, this AA stuff, it's great for my drinking and my clonopin problem, but I need something else. So I went off on a bunch of quests to do different things to make myself feel better. A lot of self-help, a lot of religion, a lot of this, a lot of that. And then finally, at about 5.5 years sober, I couldn't take it anymore. And I fired Val and went to Sammy, another great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, really good woman. And she was trying to help me because I think I needed my mommy's helpers again because I have something wrong with my brain, you see, and I have anxiety and I really need Klonopin. Val's like, no, you're not going to make, you're probably going to drink if you do that. You don't know, you're not a doctor. So I got rid of her and got with Sammy and ended up 5.5 years sober in another psych ward. And there are some other ones in between there. I just can't remember them all. But I literally went to an AA workshop conference. This guy named Keith Lewis, who's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I left there feeling so distraught and so broken and so scared. I drove and checked myself in to a hospital because I was coming apart. And anyway, I ended up, it's all a blur. I ended up 3 days after my 6 year, I got out of the hospital. They loaded me up on a bunch of stuff. And then 3 days after my 6 years, I drank. And when they say it's progressive, they're not kidding. I went into a blackout probably within the first half an hour. I called my sponsor at the time, Sammy, and cussed her out because it was her fault. She wouldn't show me enough love or something. It was somebody's fault. It wasn't mine. And then I went to a level of insanity I didn't know existed. That's why I can't believe I'm alive. I drank around the clock. My husband was working out of the country at the time. Our son was about, let's see, so I relapsed in 2004. So he was, but 10. He was 10. So he had never really seen either one, you know, a strength. Well, he had seen him drink, but he was like 2 when I first got sober. That was out for a while. So he was about 4. So he had never seen his mother drunk. And he got to see it then. He liked it at first because he was 10, 11. He was skateboarding and all that stuff. And I was, I started drinking. I cut off everybody from AA and just drank around the clock. And he would have his friends over. And I vaguely remember parents at the door getting their kids like 3 in the morning. I do know that he had a skateboarding accident and busted his head, and I don't recall it. And it got to a point where it wasn't fun for me anymore. It was scary. And it's just all a blur to me. But I know that I did everything I could do to come back to AA. I wanted to come back to AA. I knew that I was an alcoholic. I knew that AA worked, but I don't know if it was ego or what, you know, and all these people I used to sponsor and all that, you know. I mean, what are people going to think? And then I would try to go to the meeting to pick up a white chip, and I would have to pull over at the store, Wawa, and get a 12-pack and a bottle of wine and just, you know, like blot out. I like oblivion, man. I don't want to deal with anything. And it was just so scary. Like, you know, drinking against your will. Like, I would get up in the morning and like, I'm not going to drink. I'm not drinking. I'm going to go to the meeting. I'm going to get sober. I know what to do. I've been in AA before. And all of a sudden I find myself chugging. I don't even make drinks anymore. I'm chugging out of a bottle of vodka with tears running down my face. Like, and knowing I'm going to die and knowing there's not a thing undo about it. And so through that, I got to get a full knowledge of my condition, but there was still more. I mean, it was just bad. I can't even tell you, but what happened is we had, in the past, have been involved in this thing called, it was not that we did for AA, but it was like I think I saw it out there, Celebrate Recovery. It's a 12-step based type church thing that we had gone to. And one of the women that was my age, she was 46, and she had a child my age. She had been in and out, and she put a gun to her head and killed herself. And I heard about it, and I went to stop drinking. And the pastor there, they all knew me and knew I'd been sober. And it scared me. I said, I'm drinking, and I can't stop. And they got into action because the next day they show up at my house. They take my son. They want to take me to the hospital. And this is how far gone I was. I had stayed up all night drinking, and the sun was coming, drinking wine, smoking. All I did was drink. And they came, and I'm like, oh. And they're like, we want to take you to the hospital. I'm like, I don't think I'm that bad. I had totally lost touch with reality. I was dying. They knew it. And I thought I was okay. And the only reason I went is like, well, they're so nice. I don't want to hurt their feelings. That's how, and so they put me in the hospital. I was there for 10 days and then went to rehab. But anyway, I had lost touch with reality. And that's why I can't, I've seen so many people like me die. You know, and so many people in and out. And that's why I cannot, I don't know why. I'm just grateful, you know, that I've gotten to stay here. And I'm going to do everything I can to stay here. But anyway, so I went away to rehab and blah, 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 blah. And came back. And I relapsed one more time. And so that's May 30th, 2006 is when I got sober. And that's when I surrendered all of me, my panic, my depression, my all of me. You know, I compartmentalized, like, well, here's alcoholism, but I have something wrong with me. Yeah, I have something wrong with my brain. It's a bad case of alcoholism that is going to kill me. And so I needed to treat that, and that's where I was out of ideas. I got this woman, Christy. She just celebrated 30 years this year, my sponsor. Her, Sammy, and Val are the three strong women in Richmond, and I call them the Holy Trinity. And they all are big book women, and they show me the directions. And for me to have an experience with this, it's my experience, to take my mess of a life and take through these steps and start practicing the principles and living this as a way of life. And that's what I became willing to do. When I got here, and if there's any people in here that are, you know, habitual relapses, you're like, oh, my God, AA. When I showed up here, I didn't think AA would work because I had done it before. I didn't think that this God would do anything with me or help me. And I found that it doesn't matter what you think, it matters what you do. I became willing to be sponsored, I became willing to take direction, and I became willing to be accountable and show up and stay committed and take the actions despite what I thought, felt, and believed. And I used these 12 steps to walk out through that hell with the sponsor. And and I can't believe it. I mean, and it's a way of life. I'm a, as I say, a 24/7 member of Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, oh, I'm taking a little break. I'm like, oh, my God, well, your alcoholism's not. I mean, mine did. Mine kicked me in the butt, man. So, anyway, one of the other things I just want to say that I learned from that relapse is I don't get struck drunk. It starts with, you know, backing away from the meeting, and I'm too busy. Well, I'm 10 years sober. I don't know. I need to do more. I mean, but, you know, the thing I've done right is I've continued to consistently and persistently show up and do the best I can. I'm very imperfect, and that's okay. I use step 10 a lot. It's wonderful. And, but the thing that came to me when I came back after really almost dying and in 2006 was, I've been through that book so many times, but where it talks in the doctor's opinion that, you know, we drink because we like the effect and we admit it's injurious, and but the part where it says we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking a drink. I thought that was me in active alcoholism. I realized that's the core of my illness. I am restless, which means I need to be here, I need to be there. Nothing's ever enough. I'm like a dog chasing my tail sometimes. I'm irritable, my ass is on my shoulder, I'm easily annoyed, I'm judgmental, and just everybody's just bothering me. And then I'm discontent, which is I'm unhappy, I'm frustrated, that my hopes, desires, and dreams in my life aren't panning out, whatever. And then add, you know, I've got anxiety and depression. I had all that. No wonder I drink. My God, you know, that's me sober. That's the spiritual malady called alcoholism. That's why I know what I know. And I'm 6 years sober and alcoholics and seeing people die and know I'm going to lose my family. And I drink anyway. Because something's got to be sufficiently strong to have more power in my life than that restless, irritable discontent. And I found when I surrendered to this and live this as a way of life and help others because my life depends on it and be inconvenienced. It's been the magic thing that has kept me here and given me a life and the ability to walk through tough times. People die. We lost our baby doggy Snowball. He was 15. I made it through without being in a psych ward or drinking, you know. I mean, so I want to end. It goes by so fast. I'm all over the place. But I just got to tell you a couple things. Our son, Bob and I were doing well in our lives and our marriage and our recovery by the time our son started his downfall. First time we found out he was drinking and drugging when he was 15, he showed up at home. He was sneaking out through the doggy door. And we came back in and he was in a blackout and vomited all over the place and everything. Well, I expected he was going to try it. So, you know, I went up to his room and he's like, and I'm like, honey, are you okay? He said, Mom, I need help. I've been drinking and drugging since I've been 11 and I need help. And I'm like, so we called someone from the Young and Sober group and they came and 12-stepped him and we hand him over to you all. And he hung around for about 7 months. He was 15. And one night he showed up at our usual Friday meeting. He had vodka on his breath. And then he went off the rails. And it about killed me. I love my son more than anything. I would die for my son. And we've always been really close. And he turned into us a monster. And Bob and I, there isn't anything we wouldn't do for him. And, you know, I was crying a lot, and, you know, sometimes I would be talk to one of my girlfriends. I was like, oh, I'm just a mess. I can't come to the meeting. She said, well, where are you? I said, I'm driving to the meeting because my feet know what to do. I wanted to run off to Al-Anon. My sponsor said, nah, you have a bad case of alcoholism. You need to keep here, stay here. So I had a lot of support and walked through it. And finally, he got busted. He got a class 5 felony drug possession charge, and he was 18, and he was drinking and all that. He got put in jail. I'm going to leave him there. By then, I don't know, something had happened. It's like, you know what, anything I'm trying to do to help this child is not working. But he didn't want to go to prison, and he completed everything, and it got, you know, expunged. But in the meantime, he got a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he is a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He really is, and it's been awesome. But the first time I heard him speak, I was so excited. It's like, oh, yeah, my baby's speaking at the AA meeting. You know, I'm all proud. I'm sitting in the front row. And, you know, and he's, because I'm just thrilled to death, my son. You know, he was about a year sober or so. And so he starts telling a story, talk about growing up in AA. Because whenever I've been in AA more than I've been out. When I go, I go. We go a lot of meetings. So he grew up at the Jaywalkers meeting and the babysitting. He knew everybody in AA. And he said, yeah, I always knew I was an alcoholic, but I was going to try to party as long as I could. But then he went on to say how, you know, that he had grown up at the sober home, and then his dad was out of the country, and his mom started drinking. And he said that it terrorized him. It terrified him. And I just kind of slid down because I'd made amends and all that. But I don't know the effect I only think I know. And the thing that you love the most in the world, that is a child, the best I can do as being a mother without you all is I terrify my child. And so I kind of slid down the seat, but I was grateful to hear that because it was like, that's alcoholism, man. The thing I love the most, I terrify. But then he went on to say, he said, then, you know, he said, I saw how crazy my mom was, and she's in out of psych wards and rehab, and she was really crazy. He said, but I saw her get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, and it gave me hope. I knew it would work for me, too. So that was the greatest gift I could have given him, and I don't regret anything. My story's my story, and it's about hope. So I hope that I've been able to transmit a message that makes sense to someone. But I am truly, truly grateful to be here. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for to be alive and to be able to share with you guys. So thank you very, very much. Okay.